Hello, it's Daniel Lev Shkolnik, and it's been quite a while. For those who have been wondering about re-enchantment and this podcast, where it's at and where it's going, this is a little update that I want to give and a vision, a window into what is coming up next. The last year and a half or so has really been a transformative time for me. And particularly this last half year has, it's been nothing less than transformative, eye-opening. And to get to the point, you know, I'm at a place in my life, in my spiritual development, where what is obvious to me that needs my attention right now, both for my personal understanding of the psyche, consciousness, and what spirituality is really about, is the state of awakening, spiritual awakening, or otherwise known as enlightenment. I did not really put much focus on this previously to about half a year ago. It was something that obviously I knew about in the spiritual landscape, and I studied about it, but it was never something that I really strived for or sought to make a focus of my work. And this past summer, that changed. And I am in a place right now where I am shifting and already have shifted a lot of my focus in terms of the exploration of spirituality, mythology, religion, all of these areas, really focusing on spiritual awakening, what that is, what brings it about, and what do people do after they've experienced something like this? How do you integrate back into society? How do you live your life after such an event? I've come to find that despite what I thought before and what I think a lot of people think about spiritual awakening, it's not something that is exclusive to the Buddha or to Jesus Christ or to, you know, these, I don't think that it's an exceptional particularly rare occurrence. At least, you know, it seems like more and more the people that are studying spirituality, that are experiencing psychedelic, journeys and doing medicine work, who are, you know, exposed to so much of enlightenment literature and philosophy and concepts, that this mixture of exposure to this kind of way of looking at the world is bringing people to recognize that awakening is something that can happen much more easily than I think religious traditions may suggest. And I am really interested in that process, bringing more people to that place, and also helping people to navigate the sometimes very turbulent and very difficult experiences that come after an awakening. All that said, what I am going to be doing from here on out is I've already launched a YouTube channel called Stable Awakening that I've started to put out videos and talks on that channel. And that's going to be a place that you can go to subscribe if you want to find more of my work and my conversations going forward. I will probably launch a podcast version of that where I'll publish the audio only for those that prefer to listen on podcast apps like Spotify or Apple Podcasts and etc. So look out for that. I'll announce it in here on this podcast as well in Reenchantment. I'll also probably announce it on my Substack, which is a new email list that I've created. And if you'd like to stay in the loop in terms of email, go to stableawakening.substack.com. You can subscribe for free, or if you'd like to support me and my work, there's an option to do that as well. This conversation that I've recorded and I'm going to be presenting here in this episode is with Chuck Sarasso, who is a painter and a teacher. And he and I were connected by somebody who knows him very well, Michael Sarasso, who is on the call as well. Towards the end, there's an open dialogue and conversation with a couple of the people that took part. And Michael connected us, and Chuck just has a really clear and open way of talking about his own experiences with experiencing awakening early on in college, going in and out of psych wards for a little while until, you know, he fell into a place of real, you know, fell out of a state of samadhi or awakening, and fell into a really difficult and deep depression. And he spent years after that seeking to come back to the thing that he experienced, that state. And he's right now works as a painter and teaches other people not just how to paint, but also how to see the world in a way that is without the context that we usually project onto it, to see the world as it actually is, and to paint what you see, what you really see, instead of what you think you see. That's, I think, enough of an introduction, and hopefully this update gives you a sense of where it is that I'm at, and this conversation, I think, will do a lot to also communicate where I've come to in my own journey. And hopefully what you can expect from me going forward. And with that, here is my dialogue and conversation with Chuck Sarasso. So, Chuck, welcome. It's good to see you again.
Thank you.
You know, I don't really have, I used to do podcast interviews and you know, I'd always have like this little intro thing at the beginning, and I, you know, this is the first series, first in this hopefully ongoing series that I will like to do of these kinds of interviews and dialogues. So I don't really have a set way to start, but I guess, you know, why don't you introduce yourself to people who may not know, may not know you or what you do.
Well, live in Colorado outside of Boulder. I make a living as an artist, as a painter. Mostly I like to paint landscape, but also do other subjects, still life, portrait work. And I'm out right now in Santa Barbara, California, and it's the most exquisite landscape I've ever experienced. So I'm in heaven, another level of it here in this beautiful place. So I've been painting for quite a few years now, probably over 50 years, and started in college. But along with my interest in the arts, I also am a musician. I've always, since I was a kid, been really curious about, you know, what is this? What is God? What is, I was raised a Catholic. So I was very curious about the experience that Jesus had. And I thought, well, why can't I have that experience too? And, you know, he said, I guess somewhere in the Bible, I never really read it, but someone told me, he said something to the effect of, you too can do what I'm doing or achieve what I've achieved, something like that. And that is what really got me motivated to understand what's it all about.
And oh man, it's such an interesting thing because, you know, spiritual leaders like that, like, you know, I'm thinking Jesus, and I'm also thinking the Buddha are two big names that come up again and again, and they both said something to that effect where it's just like, you know, you too can achieve what I've achieved.
Right.
And ironically, in Christianity and in Buddhism as well, there is this tendency of putting them on a pedestal or at a distance of, and I'm not saying all Christians or all Buddhists think like this, but there seems to be a tendency to be like, this was a unique individual and, you know, the Buddha's enlightenment is somehow unique and special. And Jesus's connection with the divine is unique and special. He was, and I find that, I mean, it's this distance that, ironically, the religions themselves almost seem to prevent people from achieving that because of the kind of worship that dynamic that results there.
I think so. I think also, in my experience, I've found, you know, that it's all very, well, more so Christianity or Catholicism than Buddhism, but there's a real tendency to get stuck in a conceptual framework, a dogmatic process that, you know, you develop a set of beliefs about life and Jesus or Buddha, and you live from those beliefs. And I think that's probably why it's not breeding more Christs and Buddhas.
I think Alan Watts once said, like, the greatest blasphemy is to say that you're God.
Yeah. And which, yet it's the truth.
And yet it's the truth. Yeah. And you know, he said that also, if I remember correctly, in the context of a talk he was giving on psychology. And saying that in psychology there's a similar kind of prejudice or resistance to, you know, if somebody comes into the office or is checked into the mental ward saying that they're God, you put them on sedatives and you you know, you try and bring them back to good sense. I talked a little bit about your experience. Yeah. If you could say a bit about your experience with that.
Well, so in college, I had quite a, you know, opening in consciousness or in awareness, and was experiencing myself as this, my idea of what God was or the divine. And that, so as I tried to talk about it, people were pretty shocked, and I ended up in a couple of different facilities And it was fascinating because in both places, in one place in particular, I met a guy who was having the same experience I was having. And we became kind of cohorts in disrupting the whole place. And it was just a fascinating experience, really, in terms of, you know, that thing of how conventional psychology sees people as, you know, mentally ill. Every time I would meet a new person, often I would have the experience, well, not every time, but often I'd have the experience of meeting someone and I would say, how long have you been on the staff here? And they would say, I'm a patient. And then there were times I said, I met some staff people and I asked them, you know, how long have you been a patient here? You know, look at me funny. So I think, it's indicative of the whole kind of mindset around insanity. You know, I think I'm happy to be insane from the perspective of our culture. As I look at our culture, I think it's insane, so we're even.
Yeah, you know, a friend of mine was reading Foucault lately, and I haven't read much Foucault, but he talks about the way in which mental illness was kind of weaponized, and I feel as, you know, as though in my own understanding of the psyche, you know, I work a lot with internal family systems and parts work. And there's this idea that we have certain protector parts that try to manage our lives and manage the world around us to prevent, you know, to prevent harm is really what they're trying to do. And something that Richard Schwartz, who is the founder, you know, of IFS, talks about is the way in which systems imitate each other on different levels. And so he says, you know, what is true on an individual psyche for an individual person is also often true in their family, in their neighborhood, in their culture. And, you know, looking at the way in which we, you know, as a society, you know, try to manage and control what is sane and what is insane, like what is within the bounds of consciousness that is acceptable. It's something, you know, I can't help but see this well-meaning instinct to try and protect, you know, others and also the people that are suffering, but it coming from a place of, you know, a blindness of not really understanding what is going on, and so sticking in people who are, you know, who are having these awakening experiences into a framework of disorder, you know, and even I'm not even really sure about those people who have disorders, like how much is that really a disorder and how much is that a irrational response to a crazy circumstance that person finds themselves in.
These are complex issues and questions. I think I get how traditional psychology might not be able to grasp the awakened state because it's not a mental state. And, you know, it's not imaginable even. You can't think your way into it. You can't get there with the mind. And so psychology seems mostly about working with the mind. It makes sense to me that it's in general, not even a recognized state or having value. Yeah, and, you know, and then there's probably the idea that you can expand consciousness or have a deep awakening to the to this beingness. And I lost the thread of it. I don't know what happened. We can let that go.
What it seems like to me when I look at psychology is like the mind trying to repair the mind, mind work on the mind. And, you know, my mother's a psychologist and I have studied a lot of it. And I find it, my perspective on it is I find it useful in, you know, in kind of horizontal integration is what I've heard it called, like creating healing the parts of our ego or of our psyche that are carrying burdens and wounds from earlier in life. So it's ego wholeness is how I perceive it. And spirituality and what we're talking about in terms of awakened states is ego transcendence, where you're not so much rejecting the ego, but you're accepting it and going beyond. And recognizing that really there is no bound to the self. And I've, you know, in my work, I try and help people to have that wholeness first so that the ego feels secure enough to let go and then move beyond.
Yeah, I think that's really well said and absolutely true. It's not like we can ignore the structures of our egos and be awakened or stay in the awakened state. I think it's really an issue of identity. And so it does help to first begin to experience what a healthy identity as a separate being, as, you know, like for me, Chuck with this body, when that is beginning to taste health, then it does become easier to have the curiosity to explore maybe if there's something beyond that. And also a greater capacity to recognize it and stay with it, you know. And then it doesn't seem like, I think I had this idea in the early days that awakening was a one-shot experience, you know. I'm going to experience enlightenment. And then I'm there and that's it. And, you know, and it doesn't seem to be that at all. And as I've become more and more aware of my beingness, what I also notice is that is, I think, facilitating deeper unconscious beliefs, having them rise up into consciousness and begin to have the opportunity to be free of those beliefs. So it's not a one fell swoop, or maybe it is for some people. It hasn't been for me. It's been this steady process of realizing that this experience of being is where it's at, and the experience of being Chuck is not the deeper reality or the enduring reality.
Yeah, you had some, you know, last we spoke, you had some really beautiful ways of talking about that, about the relationship of Chuck to being, to the greater reality. And I just found them so helpful. You know, I'd love for you to Yeah, talk a little bit about how you came to think about that relationship.
You know, I think the big turning point happened when I had this insight that I'm not Chuck waking up. I'm the awake state realizing I'm not Chuck in any kind of exclusive way. And as that hit me, that it was, you know, at first it was like curious and, oh, wow, that makes sense. And then as the years went on, it became the catalyst that brought that awareness more and more present forward. The simple understanding that I'm not Chuck waking up, I'm the awake state realizing I'm not Chuck. That was a profound step for me. And it continues, you know, now there's the experience of being, that seems right now as the best word to try to describe what we were saying is God. You know, I don't usually use that word, but more that this awake state is really just the pure state of being without identity, without the experience of an I connected to it. And within that is everything that is the world, that within that I find my body, this body, and every other body, as well as, you know, the whole universe. It's all right here. That has been probably the biggest surprise in this process of making that switch in identity. And the immediacy of this is, it's so easy for the mind to hold this away from ourselves, you know, that the idea that I can be like Jesus or I can be like Buddha, but that's like way down the road. It's something far away. And that insight brought it to a place of immediacy. Oh, I don't have to attain this. I just have to sort of sort through everything to recognize where it sits. And in doing that, it's been finding that everything sits in this space of beingness. And that there actually isn't an I connected to it. An identity. There is, like, there does seem to be the I that is this beingness, but it's not the experience of the beingness. It arises somehow after that. And that I is the wholeness, is encompassing everything. So I think that's where, you know, that statement, I am God, arises from. Yeah, and so it, it continues. It is clearly not an end state, this beingness. It seems to open more and more. We talked about that last week about, God, I forgot. I had his name since we talked and I lost it again. You know, making that statement as first there's the awakening, and then there's that process of sifting through all the unconsciousness and or having all that unconsciousness, the fears, the self-judgments, the feelings of inadequacy, the beliefs in inadequacy, and all of those things continue to rise up and be released, which then he described it as this, think of the body as having holes in it, and light comes through the holes. And as we continue that process of, you know, raising through the fears and insecurities, the holes get bigger and bigger. The human consciousness becomes, this is what seems to be happening, is that the human consciousness is actually becoming the awake state. As it clears out the conceptual base, all the ideas that create our fears and insecurities, as we free ourselves from them, it actually seems like the mind starts to disappear. It's like I noticed that a lot of the time there's no thoughts going on here. And there's just this aliveness, this presence. And there's even a feeling often accompanying it that this body is invisible. And I think it's the way the mind is beginning to understand beingness at another level where it is invisible. What we are cannot be perceived. You know, you can't see beingness. You can't see the awake state. You can't hear it. I so far haven't been able to smell it or taste it, except as a state of being. So it's an interesting thing of, I think, you know, the holes getting bigger and bigger, more and more light coming through that form, that consciousness, and the disillusion of the conceptual reality or basis. Still, of course, I'm having access to mind and thought, and I can speak, but I usually don't know what I'm going to say until I hear it coming out of my mouth. Mm-hmm. Not just in terms of like a conversation like this about it, but in just hanging with friends and being in the world. It's a fascinating experience of, it all seems to take care of itself and doesn't need an I to direct it.
And you'd spoken about this the other week as, you know, sitting in the audience watching a movie, you know, mm-hmm. the movie of life with great yeah. actors and drama mm-hmm. and all this, these plot twists, and just observing as it happens.
Yeah, it's almost ironic where I feel so removed from the world, and yet at the same time, more fully engaged than ever before. Mm-hmm. Because I think it's like I'm not looking for anything from the world. I'm not choosing like, oh, I want that experience, or I make choices, but it's without a sense of this will make me better or make my life better or my experience better. And so then I find there's a greater ability to be with what is and to find in what is the richness that it offers.
Yeah. That's beautiful, you know. And such in such direct contrast to what so much of our society is based on in terms of doing, mm-hmm. doing, becoming, achieving, you know. And this is very much, and that's the thing. I think a lot of people have this fear or this idea, and I did as well, that if you are detached from everything in this way, then you wouldn't do anything. Mm-hmm. Like, what would be the motivation? How would you get around in the world and take care of yourself? But as you describe it, it's quite, you know, the reality is like you just don't have to worry about it. It will take care of itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's just the height of irony that, you know, so much of our, so much of what we try to do with good intentions in the world to fix the world is oftentimes the very things that get us more entangled mm-hmm. In the problems we already have.
Mm-hmm. You're familiar, we talked about, I think, Nisargadatta. You're familiar with Nisargadatta?
Remind me.
Well, he was an Indian teacher. He died in the 50s, I think, the late 50s. You know, he was amazing. Reading, he would have conversations with students, and he would never set himself up like, I'm a spiritual teacher or anything. He said, people come to me, and so I talk, but he had no kind of identity with it, at least that it was at all apparent. And people would come to him and say, well, why aren't you out in the world with this, and why aren't you making the world a better place? His answer would always be something like, well, first find out what you are and what the world is, and then ask yourself that question. And I think what he would speak to is, you identify me as this body, and you think what I'm doing or not doing is happening only with this body. And he said, I don't identify you as your body, and I don't identify myself as this body. And so what I am is for you. You can find out for yourself, because you are that as well. And so any questions of doing to make a difference, see first the truth of what you are, and then see if that question has value for you.
Yeah. Yeah. There's, you know, because you look around at the world, and from a perspective of really being awake to the reality of being, you look around and it's like, oh, it's already perfect. Like, there's this perfection that reigns throughout the universe in all directions.
Yeah. And it may not look perfect from a mental perspective. If we look at just what's happening in this country in the political arena, that doesn't seem very perfect at all. And yet, I think for myself, a simple way to understand it is, everything is the divine. Everything is this beingness. So how can there be something wrong? And, you know, the mind tends to look at the beautiful experiences as perfect, you know, when two people are really connected and loving, and, you know, that's perfect. But perfection in reality has no good or bad attached to it. It is that just what is. What is perfect, whatever it looks like. Even like, you know that Rumi poem, The Guest House? You know, so, you know, even as what's happening is ruining our lives, just, you know, tearing it apart, still there's perfection because it is the divine at work.
I remember I had that glimpse, that realization at some point in college, that it just hit me. What if the world is perfect? And it was just such this moment. I remember exactly where I was, exactly what I was doing. And it was just such a startling moment of clarity. And then immediately after that, I was like, okay, but how do I logically make sense of that? What about this? What about that? And my mind just, you know, started revving again, right? And I just, and my mind could never, I tried to justify it, tried to write about it, and I never could really express it in a justifiable way. And you know, but that's the thing. It's not about right and wrong. It's not about, you know, what we would like the world to be like. No, the world just is. It's this fundamental, you know, beingness of stuff and energy and form and space, and you know, all the imperfection is imperfection that we project out onto. We believe that it's there. But if you really look, you know, it's all light. It's all the divine. Yeah. I find, you know, you mentioned earlier that it's not a one and done. You know, it's not like you achieve this opening and awakened experience and suddenly you're good for the rest of your life. And I very much have found that to be true in my experience, where I'm, you know, it's been 6 or 7 months, you know, since I really had that first awakening. And I've had to do a good deal of healing. And I keep on, you know, to this day, finding things that are like, oh, that needs to be let go of as well. And there's, you know, I find parts of me striving still and fearful of letting go and trusting that everything will take care of itself. And yeah, I feel like that is, it's important to talk about that because I think a lot of people, you know, don't really recognize the work that comes after the awakening. And you know, I've heard it said that awakening isn't the end, it's just the beginning.
Exactly. Yeah, that's great. And one of the pitfalls, one of the things I had experienced was at some point as the awakening continued the process, I had this huge insight that, well, nothing matters. You know, really, well, okay, I just lost, you know, $1,000. It's all right. You know, it was just this sort of place opened up where it just didn't matter. And then I did an interesting thing with it unconsciously. I made that a belief. And that became where I was operating from. I wasn't operating in the aliveness of presence anymore. I was operating from this understanding, but it's conceptual, that nothing really matters. And so, but it becomes, we talked about this last week, you know, like it, for a long time, I was fascinated by answers. And then what I learned was that answers just create more beliefs, more concepts to hold on to. Questions keep us in the aliveness, you know. And so But I noticed after a few years of living from this concept that nothing matters, I suddenly started having pretty difficult experiences, and they were mattering. and I realized, I saw it just like, oh my God, I left this whole process and latched on to this idea and lived from this idea for, I don't know, some number of years. And then finally I saw it and let go of that and got back to, it doesn't matter. There's no idea that's right. Where's my attention? Is it on this energy that this body has, on this aliveness, this field of energy that's here? And as long as it's there, you're awake.
Oh man, that is such an important, you know, story and dynamic that you just described. I was speaking with consciousness teacher, Saeed Khan, and he described, you know, there are traps along the path. You know, there are traps before awakening, there are traps after awakening.
Absolutely.
And you know, I feel like you just described one really, really succinctly there.
You know, it seems that as we go deeper into the awakening, the mind gets more and more subtle, more and more powerful in its ways of trapping our attention. And so that, yeah, it's almost more work to begin to recognize these subtle ways that a concept takes over, and how quickly an idea can take hold. So yeah, it's just the beginning, awakening.
you know, and it's funny, but you know, I imagine you know, if somebody was listening to this and they feel like they haven't awakened, they're like, oh boy, you know. What an overwhelming thing just to think about that. But at the same time, it's like, you know, I've, at least in looking back at my life, there were moments that I can look back on and point to. It's like, no, I had that clarity, whether it was for a moment or like for a day or a couple days.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't recognize it for what it was. And I didn't realize what I was experiencing. I just knew that it felt great. And I was like, great, I feel on top of the world. I must, you know, whatever I'm doing, I want to keep doing it. And inevitably, you know, because I really didn't know what was going on, mine would take over and I'd fall back into stuckness. And so I guess, like, you know, and I think Eckhart Tolle talks about, like, when we do like extreme sports, or, you know, when we're in a crisis situation, like, thought disappears, you know. It's just you act, you're totally present. And if you are for a moment not present, then you might die. and we usually don't think of that as the same state, but it, you know, in a way it is. It's total presence with what is. We just don't recognize it as that.
Yeah. You know, it's really, at first, when I can't remember who, someone said that the thing to get interested in is awareness. Focus awareness on itself. And at first, you know, I thought awareness, well, I'm aware right now. I'm aware of what I'm thinking. And that doesn't seem very monumental, or I think it's, you know, because I had concepts that got in the way of how monumental that simple awareness is. And so it took a while to begin to notice, well, what is this awareness? And sort of kind of open the door of it and really step into it and just, what am I noticing? Just what am I noticing about awareness? And then over the years of that kind of process, awareness became center stage. And, oh, this is what it's about. This is what we think of as God. This is it. And at first, there's no big deal. Like, well, so what? I'm aware. You know, yeah, I have awareness. Big deal. But check out what that awareness is. And there's the big surprise.
Yeah.
That comes back to that, the immediacy. It's like the mind wants to hold all of this as far away, something maybe one day I will be awakened. But we're all already awake. We're all, that's all there is the awake state, period. And when we focus that awake state on the mind, it becomes filled with all these concepts that then are more fascinating and occupying pretty much all of our attention. So, but there's nothing to attain. It's already here. It's already what we are.
Yeah. And I noticed myself, I was speaking with a good friend of mine the other day. You know, he was asking me about, you know, my experience and trying to understand it and hear more about it. And I had this nervousness about really talking about it openly, because I didn't want to create a kind of hierarchy between us.
Mm-hmm.
But I noticed, you know, and he pointed it out. It's like, I wish you would just say it. You know, just be straight with me about what you actually think and feel, you know. And I realize, oh yeah, I'm getting stuck in this, you know, not wanting to hurt someone's feelings or not wanting to create these hierarchies, when in reality there isn't a hierarchy. It's you know, he is just as awake as I am. but it's you know, there's we're just in different, I guess, levels of dream, different levels of, you know, I don't even really know how to talk about it. I still don't, I guess.
I think I tend to think about it as there's consciousness and there's beingness. And consciousness is more of a mental state. And beingness is about that awareness, about this. And so in awareness, there is not my awareness and your awareness. There's just awareness. There's just beingness. So there's no separation in that. It's not your beingness and my beingness. There's just this place of beingness. And so it's a level playing field because there's only one of us here. And then there's consciousness. And consciousness does seem to have a hierarchical nature, lower states of consciousness, you know, and raising your state of consciousness. I, for a long time, thought that as I worked to raise my consciousness, I was moving toward enlightenment. But I thought I just have to raise my consciousness enough to be enlightened. And so that was the way I thought of it. And then, you know, at some point I realized, well, wait a minute, this place of awareness, as I started looking at that more and more, this is already here. This is not part of consciousness. This is beyond consciousness, beyond any kind of individualized state. So consciousness, I think, is a function of the separateness of the bodies. And there are levels to it, but, you know, they really don't have anything to do with what awakening is about.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because, you know, Saeed Khan spoke about something similar, and I guess I'm trying to understand what that means, different levels of consciousness, you know, the oneness of being, you know, that's something you feel, right? Something that is felt and sensed. I mean, could you talk about different levels of consciousness and what, trying to understand better what that is?
Well, what I experienced back in college when that first big awakening happened, what came with it was I had certain, what maybe in the East they refer to as cities. There's, as we raise consciousness, there's certain abilities that can manifest in these higher states of consciousness. Things like walking on water, things like Milarepa was reportedly able to fly. I started having things like I could pick up an instrument I had never touched before and play it pretty well. Or I would be walking on campus and I would suddenly know I was about to run into someone I knew, and I'd turn a corner and there they would be. I'd be reading a book, and it's a difficult thing to explain, but I would know a couple of chapters ahead as if I had read it. It was just once I started reading, I was suddenly ingesting more of the words than my eyes were actually getting to. I started having experiences around the, you know, we, in physics, we now understand that there really isn't any physicality. What we think of as solid matter is really more an energy field, and that there's far more space. Like if we think of a body, there's like thousands or millions of times more space than there is something solid. And with that expanded consciousness, I began to be able to see the spaces more. And so I could, you know, do pretty things that would seem pretty far out. It all felt very natural and normal to me, not to anyone else. But anyway, it was, those are the kinds of higher states of consciousness and, you know, the cities, the SIDHAIS, I think, are these abilities that are inherent within consciousness when consciousness is raised to a certain level. So things like, you know, well, whatever you can imagine is possible. And then, there's clearly that, you know, hierarchy in terms of what's possible within higher states of consciousness. But then I started realizing, well, but so what? What's this got to do with anything? It's not, this isn't about awakening. It just suddenly I've had this same thing of I've veered off course. You know, it was just so amazing. It just was fascinating to stay with it. But then it was just like, well, it's just like I've switched channels and there's this better movie on and that's taken more of my attention, but it's not any more real than the movie I was watching before in terms of this beingness. So that's where I began to really recognize the difference between consciousness and beingness. I think that the real awakened place, the beingness, there's no change in that. There's no hierarchy to that. It's the sum total of all of what is already. But there is the deepening of the recognition of it that continues over time. And I find that to be very distinct from consciousness. And I also find that as that beingness becomes more and more integrated, there is a raising of consciousness. You know, there is a not in terms of these abilities, but in terms of staying within a state of peacefulness, a state of joy, a state of love, a state of gratitude. You know, I think that these qualities are the nature of being. And when we're in touch with that, it does permeate consciousness and allows consciousness to enjoy the freedom of being.
Yeah. And, you know, I haven't experienced, you know, some of the other stranger phenomena of consciousness that you describe, but, you know, what I've sensed, you know, is that joy, that presence, that love, you know, all of that is, you know, the deeper I allow myself to descend into this understanding of being, just the more easily they come. And then that's, you know, that's really the point, it feels like, you know. And
a friend of mine wrote a beautiful poem about this, and I only remember the last line, but it's about what we're talking about. And the last line was something like, "And with this is the end of ambition." You know, the end of striving, the end of reaching for more, thinking there is more, and allowing what already is, what we already are, to become noticeable. That these states, these feelings of love, the sense of ease, of joy, of beauty. The mind is looking for all of this, thinking it's in the world, right? You know, and the irony is, oh, it's all already here.
Well, Chuck, I think this is a good point to open things up to some of our friends in the audience. I could keep going. This is great. Let's open it up. You know, Gene, Michael, you're welcome to turn on your video and mics. Let's have a more open discussion.
Mm. Excuse me.
Yeah. So what'd you, thoughts, ideas, what you guys, how you feeling, how you thinking?
Oh, a lot to process. It's always cool hearing other people's experiences.
Yeah. I mean, I know you spoke about your experience with this gene, and you know,
it's funny. I don't know if I'm awake. I don't know if I'm enlightened or any of that stuff. I just know that I'm aware of the fact that I used to be very, I'm aware of how unawake I used to be. So that's it. That's my only like measuring stick right now. I don't feel qualified to say whether I'm anything. I just know that I've very much experienced the fact that when I look back on my life, I go, oh, I was so unawake. That's the best I can do. Maybe that's, I don't know. That's the best
I can do. Relate to that quite well. Like, it's just, I look back. I was just thinking about how I was in relationships in my earlier years and, yeah. And realizing, my God, I was an asshole.
Yeah, there we go. That's I'm with you there. I hear you.
You know, and so it's, wow.
Which actually creates for some cringy moments when you like look back on your life and you're like, oh my God, I thought I had it all together and I did some dumbass shit. Not only, like you said, with relationships or just in general. So I, like I said, I have no idea if I'm in any remote way awake right now. I just know that I was so unawake before.
So there's something there measuring, saying.
Yeah, that's the only measuring stick I can give you right now.
That's great.
Which is funny too, because like I think like in the, you know, in the past, people said, "Oh, what do you think of Gene?" They'd be like, "Oh yeah, he's a pretty, you know, pretty awake, okay guy." And then I look back on it, I'm like, "No, you guys were wrong."
Yeah. Yeah. Michael and I have been having this kind of story or joke, really, about the thought of, "Huh, everything I thought might be wrong."
Yeah, yeah.
There's so much I must be wrong about.
There's so much, yeah, yeah. I'm wrong about.
And so that came out of I went to Australia when I was in third grade or something. Oh, wow. Like third grade, and it was through this program called like People to People, which I think after World War II the United States and its allies were like, the citizens of our countries should meet each other, you know, at different points of their lives. And so I went with a bunch of people from New Orleans, and I was like, I don't know, some 7 or 8 year old kid. And I remember like walking with this big group of kids. And what was so cool is we were on the left side of the street, and all the cars were driving in the same direction as we were walking, right? Because they drive on the opposite side of the road. And then all of the steering wheels were on the right side of the car. And I was like, this is so cool and mind blowing. And I'm like, and then so we're walking, and I think, you know, I'm like an 8 year old kid. So then I think there's like some cute girls who are like driving the car next to me, and I'm like waving to them. And then I look up and then hit a pole that's just sitting there on the street. And then I tell Chuck the story, and then I finish it and I say, like, and that's when I realized that there's just so much I must be wrong about in the world, because people drive on the opposite side of the road, steering wheels are on the opposite side of the car, and poles are in front of you and you don't even realize it.
You know, and in relation to, and you know, consciousness and awakening, I mean, like, I guess I'm also in a place of like, well, I don't know what I don't know. You know, there's no way that I could possibly know what I don't know. And yet there's like this I don't know, I guess this assurance or this sense of peace that I have when I contemplate, you know, and really drop into being, where it doesn't matter what I believe or don't believe or think, or you know, I could be wrong about every piece of intellectual knowledge in my life, but the being is still there. You know, we could be all in a simulation right now, hooked up to the Matrix and vats. We could be like in higher dimensional creatures, but being remains the same, you know, mm-hmm. throughout all the forms that reality could possibly take. And I guess in that I find solace.
Mm.
What I did with that, in terms of you know, what I know and what I don't know, I realized that wanting was based on what I know. And after years of not getting what I wanted, but getting something else, it showed me more of what I don't know. Mm-hmm. And there was liberation in that experience. And so I began to realize that wanting comes from what I know. Hmm. And I'm not interested in what I know anymore. I'm interested in what I don't know. And so I became uninterested in what I want. And that was a powerful shifting that allowed me to be more with what is in any given moment, because what I want is old news, but what's here is offering new news.
Hmm.
Hmm. Yeah.
There's a question that's like, that I've thought about a lot in my life. It's like, how do I know that I know? And that question is what, like, I used to be super like hyper intellectual in how I like pursued truth and understanding, and this question of how do I know that I know is like what kept me up at night about that. It's like, well, I think that I know, but I'm probably wrong. And so then the mind starts going, trying to figure out all the ways, well, what am I missing? What am I not seeing? And trying to get to this point of knowledge. And so I had this, I think at some point I had this definition of knowledge, and it was like, well, I know that I know when I can speak like extemporaneously about something, right? If I can just speak about a topic competently, like with no prompt, like I don't have, you know, it's not a multiple choice question, you know, because recognizing that I've seen those words before, that doesn't really tell you that you know. But it's like, if I can speak extemporaneously about something, then I know. But then even that, I haven't thought about this in a while, but like, there gets to some point where whether or not you know doesn't matter. And I think it has something to do with accepting the unknown unknowns, like accepting that the existence of the unknown unknown is, I don't know, it's bigger and more powerful than anything than you can know, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's this cycle of, well, I think of there's a cycle of knowledge, like, you know, the known knowns, the known unknowns. And a lot of times we live on that, the edge between the known knowns and the known unknowns. Like, I know I don't know that, so I'm going to explore that topic. But the thing that keeps happening is like things just bubble up from the unknown unknown, that, you know, things I don't even know about or don't even know to ask about just come up and are totally surprising and more incredible than anything I could imagine.
Nisargadatta said, if awakening is not completely surprising, it's not awakening.
Mm-hmm. There's, you know, I was talking with a friend of mine, you know, and he was worried about like you know, are we in a simulation? Like, what if, you know, what if we're, you know, right. All of these anxieties that I think are very popular right now. And I just said, well, so what if we are, you know, like, you know, we can realize the same truth of being on any level of consciousness, you know, as long as, you know, we can't get away from it. And I think that in the movie The Matrix, they, you know, it's, you can awaken within the simulation, and it's like, it doesn't really matter that you're in a simulation. And I think, you know, in olden days, like the dream within a dream, like, are you really awake? Well, you know, ultimately you can, it's about waking up within the dream and looking around, and you may still be in the dream, and you maybe you can't get out, but it doesn't matter that you can't get out.
Yeah, you're free of the dream, even though it still goes. It's no longer your source of well-being or your source of being, or it's just the fascinating dancing of life.
Yeah.
Has anybody ever had a lucid dream?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That whole experience where you're like, oh my God, I'm dreaming and I know I'm dreaming. What the hell?
Yeah.
And it didn't last long. I've only had it a couple times, and I like did these exercises from this book on it where, like, and it was kind of funny because it's like the exercise is in the book. Have you, like, in your waking state, constantly check if you're awake.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to do these weird little things. Like when I was reading the book, you'd be walking down the street, and one of the things was every now and then try to fly. And if you get into that habit, at one point you'll try that in a dream, and then you will fly, and then you'll go, ah, I'm in a dream.
Yeah.
And so there was a period of time where, like, just spontaneously walking around, I would just give a little skip. I'm like, okay, I'm awake. And there's, like, other tests that you do. But then the one time I finally did have the lucid dream, I'm like, oh, fuck, this is real. It didn't last very long because the shock of it was kind of, like, too much. And I recognized, okay, I'm not going to be able to stay in this state for too long. So I kind of looked around going, okay, this is wild. And then I just went back to my normal sleep.
Yeah, I think that's a good description, though.
I think there's, like, a metaphor there hidden in all of that.
Yeah, exactly, right? Samadhi, you know, you can experience the awake state spontaneously. Oh, and then it's gone.
Yeah, yeah.
Then it's back, you know. And so at first it's like the a lucid dream where it happens only for an instant, and then you just get capable of sustaining it more and more.
Yeah, I haven't gotten to that point yet
with it.
I've only had it a few times, but and it was always just like a minute, and I'm like, okay, this isn't gonna last very long, so I gotta take this all in, you know.
Yeah.
But they've actually done
I had it happen once where I was like running away from people who were chasing me in a dream, and I get to this rooftop, and like, and then I become lucid, and I'm like,
oh wow,
I'm like, look, and I'm looking around, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm on this rooftop, I'm dreaming, and I was like, wow, if I'm dreaming, I can jump off this building and I'll be alive. And then I'm like looking off the edge of the building, and I'm like, but if I'm not dreaming, I'm dead. and then this like freaked me out too much. And I was like, okay, I'm going to wake up. And then I just like lucidly like opened my eyes and then like was in my bed. And I was just like, fuck, I just wasted the lucid dream.
Yeah. I know. Well,
I feel like that there's a great metaphor for that with life itself, where, you know, if at one point we die and wake up from the life we realize, fuck, I wasted my life. you know, I could have been awake that whole time, having a great time.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was a, you know, an experience that I had that was very much where the world around me looked like a dream, and it was very intensely dreamlike. This has happened, I think, like a month ago, and it was interesting because it was you know, I hadn't had that happen before. But I was working with some of Eckhart Tolle's, things that he writes about in Be Here Now. And just like, what I find really helpful is he talks about the alertness, you know, being really alert and almost like a sharpening of the eyes. And it's like, what is right here? Can you find that peace, and that intensity as well? For me, that really that resonated. And yeah, it was a fascinating experience, and I'd be curious to try that again sometime soon, actually.
What was the was there was an exercise that was connected to that, or it was some kind of a meditation?
It wasn't so much an exercise. It was just something that I was, he talked about, you know, one measure, he says that you can check how much you are in being is how peaceful you are. And another thing he was talking about is this state of alertness. And he uses, he quoted from the New Testament, where Jesus says, like, you have to be like a servant waiting for the master to come home. And you don't know when exactly he'll come home, so you always have to be watching. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and yeah, if you're constantly watching, waiting for the master, the divine presence of reality to arrive, then you actually are realizing that it is always arriving at every moment. It is always arriving. Mm. Yeah.
That one. So that sticks out to me. So, cause y'all were talking before about how Christianity can set up this separateness from the divinity, right? It's become so pedestalized or otherized, it's like we don't have access to it. And so I don't know if I would say I was raised Catholic, but I got very into the Catholic faith and like kind of had that kind of sense of separation, but then like had that sense, like, you know, God is coming like a thief in the night, like, so be ready. And but I didn't have that sense that I was connected to it, or that it was always arriving, or that I was always here. It felt like always beyond me. And so that had set me up for all kinds of mental anxiety, like, hey, I need to be ready and perfect before it arrives. So it's interesting to hear about that kind of, to hear the verse or the phrase that you're saying, like, in this different context now, because like, hey, it's, yeah, you always, you know, be ready for God to arrive like a thief in the night, and it's already, and it's here all the time happening. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's funny.
I was
just gonna say, and like, you know, I remember when I used to do interviews, I was very much still coming from a place of mind. And when there were silences, I was like, how do I fill this up? How do I keep this entertaining for my guests or the people listening. And I've you know, just noticed over the course of today, like there have been a few silences, and I'm just much more comfortable to let them be, because I feel, you know, those are moments of being that I'm experiencing.
Mm.
You did your interview with Syed Khan. He said something about, you know, being is the space between thoughts.
Mm.
And I was like, hell yeah. I was like,
that's funny, because I once heard music defined as the space between the notes. So
right. Yeah. Yes. That's right.
Yes.
And one of my favorite psychologists and also writes about Buddhism and spirituality, John Wellwood, talks about that exact thing of like, if you really get good at noticing where one thought ends and another begins, and then focus on that space between them, you can notice that space can get larger and larger. And if you go into it, go down into that space, like, it's like, oh shit, this is it. Fuck. It just has no bottom.
Beautiful.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, because I think I was so focused on knowledge and knowing, and which is so focused on like the words and the thoughts. And I think I think that could be a way of saying like what happened is that I shifted my focus to the space between them and just fell very deep into it. And was very, that's, you know, I think that's when I first was like dissociated and disorganized, is when I fell into that space between thoughts.
Hmm. Yeah, and we touched upon it earlier, you know, about the way in which the, you know, experiences of awakening are you know, identified by the psychological system as, you know, dysfunctional or psychotic.
Mm-hmm.
But they can also, you know, lead to real instability in the lives of people that are experiencing it, when the mind starts to try and, you know, get back in and try and, you know, is grasping for some sense of stability, some sense of structure. You know, your wounds and your fears are kind of, yeah, it all comes up. And I think we didn't really talk about that as much, but it can be, you know, a really intense and disorienting and even disturbing experience for people. And, you know, Chuck, I know that you mentioned that kind of coming out of your initial, you know, samadhi-like experience, there was this fall into intense depression that you experienced. And
mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's something else that I think is important to talk about and just let people know about, that that's a real and also kind of normal thing that can happen.
Well, it's such an extraordinary awareness, the experience of awakening, and then to suddenly lose it, the contrast is pretty huge. And so, yeah, after it held for a couple of months, and then I thought I lost it, but actually it was more that it became more integrated. And but the not at the level of intensity it originally was. But the contrast is staggering. You know, being the source of everything. And then not being it. You know, it's like, oh, damn. I want that back. So yeah, I was very depressed, and I mentioned even suicidal, because I had no idea, well, how do you get back to that now? And so, yeah, I think that's quite understandable that it's less fun to be not awake after being awake.
Yeah. Well, that's something that I'd love to talk more about, but we are at an hour and a half, and I do want to be respectful of y'all's time. Chuck, thank you so much for being willing to come back, talk, you know, a second time with me, and you know, creating this recording. I had a blast, and I'm so glad that Michael, Gene, you know, you both joined us, and yeah, I had a lot of fun.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Thank you, Chuck.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. It's been fun for sure. It's a topic I love to converse about.
And thanks, Daniel. Thank you very much.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Daniel. And Michael, for making this.
Yeah, thank you guys for having the conversation. It's really fun.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation. As I said at the beginning, if you'd like to follow the work that I'm doing now, a good way to do that is to subscribe to my email list on Substack. That's stableawakening.substack.com. Or to subscribe to my YouTube channel, Stable Awakening. And there will also be a podcast that I'll be launching. And I hope that is something you'll also subscribe to. I will announce when that comes out on this podcast. And so for the time being, stick around and subscribe to some of those other platforms and channels as well, so that you keep in touch and keep up to date with my next steps. Really appreciate you listening and being a subscriber of Reenchantment all this time, and I'm excited to move forward, hopefully together, into the future.